We go for refuge to the Buddha, for he is our true teacher. We go for refuge to the Dharma, for it is the medicine for suffering. We go for refuge to the Sangha, for its members are wise and compassionate. For our talk this morning, as it is an informal one, I am happy to have you ask questions. And if you do, you can relax in the knowledge that your question will not be recorded for posterity. Only my answer. So you don't have to worry if you think it's a stupid question or embarrassing in some way. I do not want to be asked why I became a monk, which I get asked a lot. And I will tell you the answer, so you don't have to ask. Acute suffering. In two words. And I'll get back to that as we go along. Okay, so yesterday, let's see, Reverend Master Mugo spoke eloquently about meditation practice. And in so doing, she used the image of the Buddha here on the altar behind me. And so today, I will be talking about the six paramitas, as you all know. And in particular, I'm going to be talking about two of them. The first one, dana, which is usually translated as generosity of spirit, or even just giving. But in the context that I'm going to be speaking today, I would call it generosity of spirit. The third of the six paramitas is kshanti, a Sanskrit word, translated accurately as patience. Two things which we are very much in need of in today's world. I thought of when I agreed to take part in this retreat initially, Reverend Scholastica, who was organizing things, asked me what I would give as a title for my lecture, and I thought initially, oh, maybe how to live sanely in a world gone mad. Because the world does indeed seem to be going kind of off the deep end right now. It's just, you know, it's just crazy. I thought some more about it, and then I realized, well, wait a minute, I actually have these booklets that we produced at Pine Mountain Temple on the six paramitas, and actually they are the answer to that question. They are the remedy to that particular problem of how to live sanely in a crazy world. So I will try to elaborate a little bit on that as we go along. Anyway, as I mentioned, Reverend Mugo pointed out the Buddha sitting on the altar yesterday as the embodiment of meditation. And so what I'm going to try to do is talk about the altar. And I don't know how well you can see it from here, but it's a big altar, and it has a number of steps that constitute the base of it. And then there's a sort of central column portion of it, and then it actually goes uphill, or I don't know how you describe that. It arches out over space, and then you have the surface of the altar. So just imagine that those bottom tiers of this altar represent generosity of spirit and morality, keeping the precepts, living in a way that doesn't create any more unhappiness or karma or distress than we can manage to avoid. And patience. I And this analogy only occurred to me this morning, and it was because Reverend McGough talking yesterday, and I thought, you know, the middle part of that altar, you know, which is the kind of the waist of it, the narrow part, to me, that kind of represents patience. I mean, just think about that center part of the altar. That thing is holding up the whole deal. It's holding up everything that comes above it. It's holding up the weight of the whole Buddha. Right? just to elaborate a little on the metaphor, supposing that the bottom part or the entire wooden base of the altar is comprised of generosity of spirit, perceptual truth, patience, and vigor. Okay? And what those are holding up is the Buddha, which represents meditation, as Reverend Mugo pointed out yesterday. And hopefully I'm not going to push a metaphor too far here, but let us say that the body of the Buddha is meditation, and the head of it, the mind of the Buddha mind, is wisdom. So there you go. That's my metaphor. Insisted on crowding into my already crowded head. Okay. Now, there's two things that I want to impress today, besides generosity of spirit and patience. And in case you fall asleep or forget everything else I say, I'll tell you right now. Number one, everybody suffers. Okay? And that's why we practice. That's why we're here. I'm assuming everyone is here because, to some extent, we all have that same experience of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness. A more modern rendering of it might be, life is hard, and then you die. Right? You've all heard that. I like it. I'm sorry? Anyway, life is hard, and we all know that, and we all experience it. It's not getting any easier in the modern world. So whatever you experience in life, however difficult it might be, you're not alone. And this extends throughout time. One of the ancient Greek philosophers, I'm not sure which one, maybe Seneca or Plato, is supposed to have said, be kind to everyone. Everyone is carrying a burden. It's a very beautiful saying. It might even predate Buddhism, I'm not sure. But it's true. Everyone is carrying a burden. We all have our struggles. All right, so that's one thing. And the complement to that, which I hope you will remember, is to have confidence in your spiritual journey, whatever that is. Wherever you might happen to be on that journey, in the beginning, in the middle, towards the end, does not matter. Do not be discouraged by failure, because just as we all experience suffering, we all experience failure. In the grand scheme of things, it's not that important, especially since we can learn from failure. It's one of our great teachers. So have confidence in your spiritual journey, and whatever you do, don't give up. Apparently, Reverend Master Gio used to talk about her master, Keiro Chisan, and one of the things that he liked to say was, well, as long as you're willing to keep putting one step in front of the other, you're doing fine. And however simplistic that might sound, it's nevertheless very true. So, everyone suffers. Now, that truth of dukkha is one of the three marks of existence. Y'all know what the three marks of existence are? Kind of. Does anyone want to tell me what the other two, what the other ones are? Go ahead.
I was going to say greed, hatred, and illusion.
Greed, hatred, or anger and delusion are the three, what are in Buddhism called the three poisons. Yeah. Right? And so they constitute the, sort of like the driving, the nucleus, the driving force of what causes suffering. Right? And if you ever look at one of those Tibetan Tanka paintings, it shows the six realms of existence. Right in the very middle, there's a pig, a snake, and a cock, a rooster. And those represent greed, anger, and delusion. And they're sort of the driving force behind this whole huge, you know, thing of worlds of rebirth and beings coming into existence, et cetera, et cetera. Go ahead. Yeah.
Suffering, impermanence. Oh, sorry. Thank you.
Suffering, impermanence, and no soul, no self.
Okay, excellent. All right, so we've started off with dukkha or unsatisfactoriness. Impermanence is another way of talking about change, anicca. Everything changes, whether we like it or not. All of us are constantly changing. And when we look at ourselves and what we think of as me, myself, I'm always changing. And so that leads us to the third truth, or the third mark of existence, which is anatta. What is a self? Does the self have any real substantial quality to it? Does it endure? And the Buddha said, no, well, actually, no, it doesn't. The self is something that is constantly changing. And if you think about it, the self is also what gets us into the most trouble, right? Because the self is really what it is. I mean, if we want to define it, it's what we grasp after as human beings. It's what we crave and think will make us happy. The idea of a self that we can build up that might be better than someone else's seeming self. The more we sit still in the midst of these things, this seeming self, our own existence, our own fragile, temporary human existence, we see that it's not as solid and as durable as we would like it to be. Okay, it's a fragile deal. All right. So, by the way, I'm what you might call a classical Buddhism guy. That's what I'm doing here. I'm speaking about Buddhism from a sort of classical perspective, right? The three, as our friend mentioned, the three poisons of greed, anger, and delusion are what sets suffering in motion. And then once we have suffering, then we also have anatta and anicca as marks of existence. And really, when you take that whole conglomeration, it's sort of like, okay, this is the realm of existence that we've been plunked down into, right? This is the human realm. This is how it is. We can't do a thing to change it, but what we can do is learn to navigate it, okay? We can learn to study ourselves, study life, learn how to live in a way that's smooth and harmonious as much as possible, given that human life by nature is gritty, right? Human relationships tend to be gritty. Being part of a community or a family, as we all know from having grown up in a family, is a gritty business. But Buddhism puts all sorts of tools in our hands, right, for dealing with these conditions of life. So that's what I'm hoping to explore a little bit. Going back for a moment to unsatisfactoriness or suffering, I find it very interesting myself, and I've lived long enough to observe this phenomenon in society as a whole. Every time we come up with a new electronic gizmo, okay? The television predates me, but I've seen the advent of the cell phone, the personal computer, okay, and all the rest of it, the iPhone, etc. Every time we come up with one of these things, the net effect of it is to make life more complicated and frenetic. Okay? Now, I suspect that when people invent these things, they think that it will make life easier in some way. And just as a society, we always seem to be wanting to make life somehow easier, right? I mean, just watch, you know, a couple hours of television, and that's probably the central message, right, of advertising. You know, buy this thing and it'll make your life easier. It's a better it's a better gizmo than what we had before. Okay, so life is, in a way, it's sort of made up of all of these dualities. Easy versus hard are two of them. I wrote down a few of these. Where did I write down? Just the mere fact that we have day and night, okay? Stuff that we just take for granted, ocean and land, okay? I have a left hand and a right hand. In this audience, there are males and females, okay? Dualities. All these pairs of seeming, if not opposites, at least very contrasting components. Things get more complicated and difficult when we start to move into stuff like right and wrong, okay? Conservative and liberal. How about that? That's juicy. And truth and falsehood. Okay? I'd say that right now, in our society, the tug of war over truth and falsehood is probably our number one duality, okay, over which people fight, and over which there really is no apparent solution right at the moment. How do you know what you see on any sort of news media? How do you know what you see is true or false anymore, right? It's very hard to know. It's very hard to know what or who to believe. How just to take in information, right? We all struggle with this. We all live in a very complicated world. And we get dualities of right and wrong, truth versus false thrown at us constantly. And it's difficult to know how to navigate our way through those dualities. As I said, Buddhism is trying to put tools in our hands to learn to navigate through these various things. And so, in talking about the six paramitas, these are six tools for navigating the sea of life. Who can tell me, who can give me a definition of a paramita? Anyone? The best translation I think I've heard, well, among various translations, one is that they are virtues. Okay? They are simply virtues that as human beings we can be aware of and choose to adopt and try to practice. So, in the Zen tradition, we have always put heavy emphasis on the fifth of the six paramitas, jhana. Okay? Jhana, as you probably all know, was a word from Sanskrit, from India. When that school of practice came to China with Bodhidharma, it was mimicked, and they called it chan, okay, mimicking jhana. And then when it went from China to Japan, they called it zen, which is the sort of mimicry of chan. So zen, as Reverend Master Mugo explained yesterday, is central to our practice, the Zen tradition. And so is Shila, the second paramita, which represents morality and the taking of precepts, which another one of the monks during this week will be talking more about. All right, so that leaves us with what I'm going to talk about today, dana, generosity of spirit, kshanti, patience, vigor, energy, and wisdom, which sometimes is translated as skill and means. And just to reiterate a point that I made earlier in reference to this altar, if you look on the back cover of this booklet, which I'm hoping that you all have a copy of it, right, at this point? Anyway, you're welcome to. They were up in the guest house. I created this diagram of a step pyramid, and I don't know if this can be considered classical Buddhism, but it's at least what makes sense to me and what I use to, one of the things I use to teach it. At the very base of this pyramid is dana, giving, or generosity of spirit, and in a sense that holds up the whole thing, as I was mentioning before. And it provides a base or a platform for morality. Okay? Morality, in its turn, provides a base, a platform for patience. And so you go. Virya, jhana, and prajna. Each one is sort of built on the foundation of the previous one. Now, that might make it seem as if there is a ascending order of importance or a descending order of importance. I'm not trying to say that. I think they're all equally important. Okay? They're all six aspects of Buddhist practice and how we navigate the world, how we navigate a world full of dualities. But at least in my way of thinking, it's a helpful way of looking at this, and it's a way of showing us all that even though Zen, the Chan, the Jhana school emphasizes meditation, it fits in within a broader context of virtues or practices, all of which make up, Buddhist practice, or even Zen practice for that matter. All right, so speaking about dana, or generosity of spirit, a lot of us have been schooled in the meaning of dana, and it does have a sort of a specific meaning or interpretation. In which people make offerings, this is the ancient tradition of Buddhism, is that the lay people make offerings to the monks, and those are called dana offerings. And in Asia, it would, well, in America too, for that matter, it would often literally be food. You know, you put food into the monk's begging bowl as they're walking around. That's a dana offering. It could be anything. It could be cloth. There's whole ceremonies that lay people offer cloth to monks for making the robes. And by extension, people make offerings of money to support a temple or a monk living somewhere, whatever it happens to be. That's a sort of, you know, more of a strict, precise definition. But as I said earlier, I want to talk about just a little bit about dana as generosity of spirit. I will read one paragraph from this booklet. How much we give, or have to give, is irrelevant by comparison with the attitude of mind that we are able to cultivate. If a person can cultivate generosity of spirit, that will be a noble attribute and a cause for happiness throughout one's life. Exactly how generosity of spirit translates into giving of money, time, and talent, or whatever resource, is a matter for the individual to resolve for him or herself. But once the foundation of a generous attitude of mind is laid, then a person can begin to see that giving is a cause of happiness and well-being. Giving itself, generosity of spirit, uplifts the giver. It's nice to be the recipient as well. And if you learn to give, it also contains within it learning to actually be a recipient as well. Right? As a monk, I have to learn to be a recipient of all kinds of offerings. And they go into the begging bowl, whatever it is. We are grateful for whatever the offering is. Generosity of spirit is so important, I think, now in our society, because as a society with built-in tendencies and orientations, America is a society which has embraced individualism. Every man for himself. Everyone trying to make it. Everyone trying to amass wealth. So it is a competitive orientation to life. American society is by nature competitive. A striving society. People call it the rat race, but that's because of the selfishness embedded in it. Okay? I think generosity of spirit is one of the doors into, for at least for you as an individual, to change around your orientation from being competitive or striving against someone else or striving against conditions, that you're more interested in helping other people. Okay? You're more interested in being generous with what you have to make everyone a success. Okay, so you're at that point equally concerned about the larger group that you are a part of, a larger community, or in the case of Buddhism, the Sangha. We practice generosity among ourselves. And it helps change your mind. It helps change your mind around from what can I get out of it, what's in it for me, what will make life easy, those kinds of things which are so deeply embedded in our thinking in this country, to, well, maybe I can help make it better, not just for myself but for other people. I'm going to read a couple more paragraphs from this booklet. Because suffering is part of human life, and we will always experience it as long as we are alive, we need to practice steadily in ways that help us keep suffering in focus and minimize it. Dana is one of those practices. By cultivating generosity of spirit and a willingness to give, we can come to see our tendencies to clinging and selfishness ever more clearly. By studying our suffering and what kinds of behavior result in suffering, which are the first two of the Four Noble Truths, the existence of suffering, and who knows the second noble truth? Anyone? I'm sorry? The cause of it, yes, the cause of it, which is? Anybody? Craving, attachment, exactly. And we can also say craving and aversion, right? To the extent that we crave after certain things in life, we also have aversion for others, right? The world being composed of so many dualities. Okay? So, what I find very, very beautiful about the Four Noble Truths is that they lay out the difficulty of human life, suffering and then its cause, but then it gives you the answer in the third and the fourth truths. There is a cessation of suffering. And to me, I told you earlier, I became a monk as a result of, because of my own acute suffering, okay? To just hear those words, that there is a cessation of suffering, that was absolute music to my ears as a young man. And I, in a sense, embraced that truth and have never looked back, okay? I still suffer, as I said earlier, we all do. But I have a handle on it, and that to me is glorious. That is key to living sanely, okay, living happily, right, living a well-adjusted, harmonious life, living with other people, okay, that there is a cessation of suffering. How do you find the cessation of suffering? Well, you practice the Eightfold Path or the Six Perfections or the six Virtues. And there's, just as a sort of footnote, there is quite a bit of a sort of, how would you say it, a crossover or synthesizing between the six paramitas and the Eightfold Path, because they're basically talking about the same components, okay, of human life and what we develop, what we cultivate. We cultivate in the Eightfold Path, you know, right understanding, right attitude, right speech, okay, right livelihood, meditation, concentration, those things, okay, that comprise the Eightfold Path. And so in a sense, they've just sort of been remolded somewhere along the way. Someone said, well, let's talk about it in this way, you know, in the six paramitas, the six virtues. Okay, so Buddhism lays out the essential difficulty of human life. It also lays out the essential solution to the difficulty and its many facets. As I said, American society runs on competitiveness, greed for more than human beings actually need, greed simply to have more nice things and money than the next guy. These things are conditioned into us from day one, and we enter adulthood already with a complex assembly of greeds and desires in place for what we want out of life and what we think will make us happy. I'm reading, by the way, as you can tell. Unless we are able to find some spiritual discipline in life, we will spend the remaining 50 or 60 years of life struggling against impermanence, against anicca, change, or anatta, the impermanence of a self, the futility of temporary things to bring any real or lasting peace of mind and heart. Buddhism addresses this very problem and gives us practices which soften and convert greed, that we can learn to live with little, live within our means, be generous and selfless. This is a great gift that the world which is lost in its aimless materialism, this is what the world needs. It needs people who can do this, people who can live by generosity of spirit and carry that with them in their lives. Okay. Got this pile of notes here, which by the time I finished it was sort of a jumbled up pile of Dharma. Try to move on here to the paramita of patience. As I mentioned, our world today, 2017, is very contentious. I don't need to elaborate on that. You all know what I'm talking about. In the political realm, it's a dogfight. Everyone says they're right, that they have the solution or the answer. There's precious little generosity of spirit in that, isn't there? If people actually had generosity of spirit in the public arena, they might be more willing to actually just quiet down for a while, sit down and listen to what other people have to say, and maybe not insist quite so much that their view or their interpretation is the right one. So, generosity of spirit, I would think, would be the entrance into that. And then just think what patience would do we don't even really need to talk about just politics. We can talk about all of contemporary society, right? Just think what a need there is for patience in contemporary society. I think the most perhaps easy to relate to or understand facet of modern life is driving your car. We've all been on our freeway and seen people zipping ahead of us, right? Weaving in and out of traffic so you can drive 80 miles an hour or 90. I've seen people do 100 out on Interstate 5. What is that? That's just impatience, right? That's impatience in action. That's how it gets expressed. And I personally am a slow driver. I regard slowing it down as a form of patience that I choose to practice, right? And generosity. I mean, if someone wants to cut in front of me, what I say is, I often say this out loud, please go ahead. I'm braking, so you can get in front of me, right? And this happens over and over and over, that you witness impatient behavior, striving to get to the next thing, striving to get to the store or home or who knows where it is, the movie theater. Once you get there, then you're going to strive for the next thing, right? Until you get that. And then once that's done, well, it'll be time for another thing, okay? So where does that cycle end? It doesn't end. You don't ever get satisfied by saving 4 or 5 minutes of a drive by speeding and going 75 miles an hour. You know, so you gain 5 minutes, you know, and then what do you do with that? You know, you're still busy, you're still spinning. So, like Reverend Master Mugo described yesterday, patience is like meditation. It's like stillness applied to all the conditions of life. Okay? Driving your car being a good example. It's bringing an ability to just sit there for a minute and say, after you, or I can wait, you know? You know, we all know what it's like to go into a doctor's office and there's all these people and they're running behind. They always run behind. I don't know why. Why don't they just schedule more time for everybody? I guess they can't because of medical regulations or something. But anyway, there's always people in there. You always have to wait. Fine. I always say to myself, well, this is an opportunity to practice patience. I can just sit here and meditate for a while. It's not going to kill me. In fact, I enjoy it. Reverend Phoebe, Reverend Master Phoebe, my colleague and I, we sort of have an ongoing little, I don't know what you'd call it, a joke or a little reminder, really, of practice, that when something happens, and sometimes we're in a car, but sometimes we're at home and something goes wrong, busted plumbing or you know whatever it is, we'll say to each other, well, that's an opportunity to practice patience, right? You don't necessarily have to get upset. You can just look at it as, okay, well, this is human life. Things go wrong. Or you have to wait. Or somebody doesn't show up. You said they were coming. Fair enough. This is an opportunity to practice patience. As I mentioned, I think every time we invent a new gizmo, a new thing which will make life easier, somehow, I don't fully understand this, but somehow it seems to have the opposite effect in the end. It makes life more complicated and frenetic. I didn't grow up with computers, for instance, and so now I'm in the position, as many of you are, of being in middle age or even advancing age and having to deal with the innumerable, constant, overwhelming changes, you know, of dealing with computers, right? When does this end? It doesn't end. It just keeps rolling right along. It gets more and more complex. Who can put brake on that? No one, right? It's taken on a life of its own. So really, all of us as individuals, we just have to practice patients right in the middle of them. In the middle of that, smack in the middle of it. So, Reverend Master Jiu, as other, I'm sure other monks will refer to over the course of this retreat, she said that all acceptance is the key that opens up the gateless gate. I'm sure many of you have heard that expression. All acceptance. And that acceptance of conditions, or let us say, ability to sit still in the midst of conditions, okay, is a sort of an extension of the same idea. And to me, and this is, again, just my way of thinking about these things, to me, patience is sort of the embodiment. It is that practice, okay? Wherever you happen to be, whatever conditions, whatever situation, if that little niggle in you, that is a reminder that actually this may be difficult, but I can still be patient, is extraordinarily powerful. It's extraordinary. It's life-changing. It gives us the ability to be in all kinds of situations and not be thrown around, not be ruffled, not, you know, lose patience. I mean, think how easy it is, right? You lose your patience. If you've been a parent, all of you who've been parents, how easy is it to lose patience with one of your kids, right? When they're acting up and doing what kids do. I would think being a parent would be one of the ultimate challenges, right? One of the ultimate proving grounds, training grounds for the development of patience. And the ability to exhibit it, which your child then will observe and learn to do themselves, right? Because those things all get passed on from generation to generation. Because kids, I mean, all of us, we learn by example, more so, I think, than reading books or, you know, hearing a talk. We learn by example. We look at how people are and we copy them. And, you know, Reverend Master Jiu, as I mentioned before, she exhibited a lot of what we're talking about here. She exhibited stillness in the midst of conditions. Okay. She would be, you know, unhappy with people, but from time to time, but she also practiced patience, right, in that very same place. which time do I have? I've almost talked for an hour. One more thing, or a couple things I wanted to touch on here. Again, going back to our society and how it works, and I don't know how this came about, maybe it's just having capitalism as the basis of our economic system, but we've decided that time is money in this society. And as far as I'm concerned, this is one of the central delusions, okay? A shared, collectively held, or even forced upon you delusion of contemporary society. If time is money, then by extension, everything has a monetary value, right? And so what it costs to make something, what it costs to get it on the shelf, all of those things get kind of boiled down to money. And in the process, all of the spiritual underlying values, okay, that we all hold, that we all try to practice, those all get kind of swept, right? They get lost, they get swept away. So, in recognition of this, I have, in my own life and in my own practice, deliberately said to myself, screw it. Time is not money. Okay? Time is time. I have all the time there is. Isn't that some Christian nun, Julian of Norwich or something, that said, we have all the time there is. I love that. I love that expression. We have all the time there is. In other words, we're not going to cave in to the pressure, the constant pressure of time is money. So what that has meant for me is that I'm willing to do things that the world thinks is a waste of time. Right? I've made a career out of recycling stuff that the world pitches out. You know, for a long time here at the Abbey, we used to build stuff out of recycled lumber because we didn't have the money, you know, to just go down to the lumber yard and buy, right, all the lumber we needed to build a couple sections of cloister. So we recycled it. We'd tear down a house and recycle the wood. Or we'd have a big pile of wood that somebody gives us. And, well, what do you do with that? You take the time to go through it, pull out the hardware, plane it down if need be, and reuse it. It's beautiful stuff. But that requires saying, I don't care about the time. This is important, and I'm going to put care and attention into it, because those are more important than money. Love, care, and attention, patience, right? It takes patience to, you know, take something that's old, beaten up, that normally would get pitched out, and fix it, you know, and reuse it. So, anyway, not to make too fine a point of it, but for me, time is not money. I don't care what anybody says. I'll take as much time as I need to do something, and if that means fixing up something that's old and seemingly useless, I will do it. So that is part of patience practice. I think it's also part of generosity of spirit, okay, that we offer the world. We don't have to be consumers at every turn. We don't have to always be in search of the latest and greatest gizmo, okay, which might just make your life more frenetic than it was before. Okay, so I apologize for speaking so long, perhaps longer than I should have done. I will, at this point, allow any of you to make a comment or ask a question if you would like to. Perfect description of how training works. We have things that we're already patient with, and then we discover, oh, well, here's a situation where I lose it. Yeah? And I'm not happy with myself for losing it, right? But as you point out, getting upset with yourself or getting impatient or frustrated with yourself, that doesn't really help either, right? It's understandable, but it doesn't help. So then that little voice that says, well, remember to turn compassion inwards. That does change things, right? So then you look at the very thing that's uncomfortable, the very thing that's distressing, both the trigger, A, and then your reaction to it, B, and then however that plays out, right? Karmic cause and effect, C. And it's sort of like you hold that in all acceptance of loving kindness, what we call metta. You just hold that. And it's a miracle. I don't know how it works, but that dissipates the anger energy or the impatient energy or whatever it is that sets it off in the first place. But thank you for, you know, for that very well articulated question, because I mean, isn't that is training right there? Yeah. Anyone else? Tying the paramitas together with the precepts. If you look on the cover of this booklet, there's a little image which I just found on the internet somewhere. I have no idea where. It says, generosity versus miserliness. Okay? So, the very first one is the eighth precept. Do not be mean in giving dharma or wealth. Just don't be stingy, right? Don't be mean-spirited. Be generous, right? Okay? Ethics versus wanting to harm. Well, that's all of the precepts, right? Yeah. Starting with don't kill, don't steal, sexual misconduct, all of those things. Patience versus hatred. And that's something I've been, I didn't use it in so many words as I was talking, but isn't that really what we're dealing with, is anger and hatred, which are all around us. I mean, the kind of ambient level of anger and hatred in the society is going up and up and up and up. Do not be angry is the ninth precept, right? So it's learning to cultivate within yourself the antidote, right? The antidote to those things which are causing so much unhappiness. Yeah. And none of us are perfect, so realistically we have to say, these are all guidelines for how to live, right? And they may seem like absolute boundaries, but in fact, we have to kill life forms in order to eat, right? Mm-hmm. So let's be practical as well and recognize that there are consequences to actions. It's all about cause and effect, right? Mm-hmm. And learning to accept consequences, whatever they are, and learning to do the very best you can, okay, in any situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, again, I can't sit here and give an absolute answer that. At what point does a society have to draw the line and say, okay, things are way out of hand, and so now, some sort of coercive action has to be taken? I don't know where that line is. And things take on a life of their own. Right?
I guess
that is the worldly response, right? And so what we're trying to do as Buddhists is develop a Buddhist response, which is based on compassion, right? It's based on generosity of spirit, seeing that other people, we all have the same problems, right? We all have greed, anger, and delusion, and we're all struggling in our own ways to deal with them. And we just simply benefit the people around us more if we don't go there, right? Yeah. It doesn't spell out in every detail how to act in every given situation, but it points you in the right direction.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay. You mentioned placing things on the altar of the heart, which is a practice that Reverend Master Jiu taught many of us, or all of us. Certainly had a huge impact on me. Right, it had an absolutely fundamental, life-changing impact on me. Whatever it is about me that I don't like, and there has always been plenty. Right, I'm hard on myself by nature. When I find myself in that moment, right, of calling myself an idiot, then I say, "Well, wait a minute. That's not actually true, I don't have to believe in that, that old conditioning, that voice that's sort of saying, meh, 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 So why not just put that up on the altar, right? Give it to the Buddha or give it to Kuan Yin or Kuan Zeon. Because then, like we were discussing a few minutes ago, it's like, well, that allows the energy, the impatience, the unacceptance to dissipate, which it does. You just have to be willing to let, really, look at what you're doing. It's a little moment of willingness to let go of something, to offer it up. I vow to undertake the training to refrain from self-righteous indignation. And when I slip up, rather than continue to be angry and turn anger inwards, I'm going to turn compassion inwards. And that turns the whole thing around. Yeah. So that's the really the core vow, as you say, is the vow to undertake training, right?
Call it practice.
Call it practice. And then the precepts are all the many manifestations that that takes.
It doesn't always work, but it works better than not doing it.
Right. Okay. Well, that's, you know, a good point, and a sort of poignant observation that, yes, indeed, meditation is the tool which empowers all of these things. I think the inherent difficulty in this might be one of language, actually. Because if you think of meditation in a little, well, it has its narrower definition and its broader definition, okay? Like so many things. The narrower definition of meditation is to sit on a cushion and look at the wall, right? Or do walking meditation, or stand in line and recite a mantra because, you know, you don't want to be impatient, okay? So I understand completely what you're saying. On the other hand, meditation can be more like something that, well, you know, the image that Reverend Master Mugol gave yesterday of you burn a stick of incense and that permeates the whole room, every nook and cranny. Well, if you practice meditation enough, if you practice actually all of this, these virtues, then that's what happens. Meditation just permeates into all of your life. Okay? Basic mindfulness permeates into your life, and it isn't necessarily something that you're consciously aware of, right? You don't have to go along saying, okay, now I'm meditating, right? Because that's an extra thing that you put on top of it. That's a kind of self-consciousness. Whereas what we're talking about is just pure awareness, right? Just plain awareness. And so that's what's happening. The more you practice, the more that just basic pure awareness permeates everything you do. That makes sense. I would agree absolutely with the last thing you said, that to put your energy into inclusive activities as opposed to divisive activities. That's what ultimately helps. I mean, that's what helps society at large. To be able to see all beings as Buddha is, of course, one of the main tenets of our teaching of the Zen tradition, and Reverend Master Jiyu certainly taught it. It's not an easy place to arrive at, certainly. But if you really want to look beyond all of the apparent differences, all the superficial differences among people, you can arrive at that vision, so to speak, of the oneness of all beings and the Buddhahood of all beings, definitely. It doesn't end there, because then there's seeing things as all is one. And then as soon as you turn around and engage in some kind of activity, then all is different is right there. And you have to, and really that's what the wisdom paramita is about. The wisdom paramita is about, okay, we've learned to see everything as all as Buddha, and that's wonderful and beautiful. And there's still reality. You know, there's still all this different. We can't get away from that either, even if we might want to, and just dwell forever in a sort of, you know, blissful state of all is one. So, you know, it's not an easy thing, learning real skill and means, and, you know, how we can actually put into practice the bodhisattva vows to help all sentient beings in their own way. And I'm sure my fellow monks will agree that that's a lifetime proposition. It's a lifetime undertaking to learn how to do that, to learn all the ins and outs of, okay, yes, we're all one, but we're all different too, and so we're going to learn. There's a necessity and a need to learn skillful means to help all sorts of varying individuals and all sorts of varying situations. It points to another basic reality, another law of existence, which is that the universe isn't really answerable to my personal will or yours, right? And so all of our ideals, all of our noble conclusions about, well, this isn't, you know, this is the way things should be, and they're not, so I have every right to be unhappy about it. Well, the universe is big, you know, and way, way bigger than me. Anatta has shown me that I'm just kind of a little grain of sand in the Ganges, and so I have to let go of that, right, insistence or the ideal that things be a particular way. Because I know from experience that that isn't going to happen. But I can work on me. I can work on how I am. There's merit there in investing energy there. Okay. Before I stop, everybody suffers. Right? Everybody suffers. It's a law of existence. We can do something about it. That's why we practice. That's why we train. Carry that with you. Have confidence in your spiritual journey. Carry that with you. You can do this. And it does evolve. It does continue to lead you to progressively deeper levels of truth, understanding, and peace within yourself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.